delighted to welcome students with us today. We have first Believers in Christ High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We have Berlin High School students. Would they stand, please? We're delighted to welcome you, too. You may be seated. And we have students expected, at least, from UW, University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Are they here? Good. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The UW-Stevens Point students are traditional, come to the court. The high school students are part of the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to come for an oral argument. They accept the invitation. They've been given your briefs, the case that we are about to hear, and they have done some extra activities about this case. And then, as part of the program, they will meet at noon after the second case with a justice of this court to discuss the procedures of the court in hearing cases and deciding them. The substantive issues will not be discussed. Everyone is invited to attend that session at noon. And today, the session will be conducted by Justice Lewis Butler, who is the justice on my far left. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack.
Born in the Berlin Hospital.
Are we okay?
Well, I was going to tell you, I was born in the Berlin Hospital.
Oh, well, I just found out something new, exciting, and interesting. You announce it, Justice Wilcox.
No, I'll let you.
Justice Wilcox was born in the Berlin Hospital.
Should we applaud?
All right. This is the last day of oral argument of this court before we meet again in September. So the court is celebrating. We have another announcement. Okay, I will not announce that, Justice Bradley. All right. We will now call our first case for this morning, 03-1067, Elaine Marie Cohn versus Darlington Community Schools, appearing for the Illinois Tool Works, Inc., which is one of the defendants, is Michael B. Apfeld of Godfrey & Kahn. Mr. Apfeld.
May it please the Court. My name is Mike Apfeld. With me at council table is Josh Johangenmeyer, and we do represent defendant, respondent, petitioner, Illinois Tool Works, sometimes referred to as ITW. This appeal arises out of an accident occurring at certain bleachers at the Darlington High School in September of 2000, roughly 31 years after those bleachers were installed. ITW, who is alleged to be a third-generation successor to the company who sold the bleachers in 1969, moved for summary judgment on the basis that the statute of repose applicable to improvements in real estate barred the action. The trial court agreed, the court of appeals disagreed, and this court granted review. In its current posture, two issues now face the court. First, are bleachers, or are these bleachers in question, an improvement to real property, as that term is used within the statute? And if so, is the statute of repose constitutional? Because the first issue is logically primary, I propose to address it first.
Okay. My question in that is that bleachers are very movable, aren't they? When I think of is there a different – there are bleachers inside, say, a high school gymnasium. There's these are football field bleachers. How are these attached?
Well, of course, there are bleachers, and we are concerned about these particular bleachers in question. Now, let me tell you what I know to be the case, and let me tell you what the Court of Appeals thought to be the case. What I know to be the case is that these bleachers are bolted to an asphalt base, which stretches the entire length and breadth of the bleachers. If you look at the pictures, you will see this. You will see that the level surface on which it is placed, which has been partially excavated from the surrounding vicinity. Presumably, although this is clearly not in the record, the asphalt was not laid on top of dirt. It's almost always laid on top of crushed stone. It also is there, was put in place, and remains in place by virtue of its own great weight. This is not a set of bleachers that can be picked up and moved somewhere at will. It is over 100 feet long, 15 rows high. In the subsequent years, there has been a press box added to it, and closely nearby, although possibly not attached to it, is an additional bleacher for wheelchair seating. This is a massive structure, which I think is apparent. Now, the Court of Appeals claimed not to be able to discern the bolts in the pictures, and frankly, the pictures which are contained in the record are of poor quality. If this case hinged upon the question of bolts, I can assure you that we would be able to prove, if this matter were remanded, that there are, in fact, bolts that run from the angle irons, the horizontal angle irons, into the asphalt. But clearly, for one who has not seen it, it's difficult to pick that up from the photographic evidence in the record.
Well, the reason I asked is because the Court of Appeals used the Massey case. That was the case, as
yes.
I recall, had the water slide, which water slide indicating it's in some lake, I assume, normally might be removed for the winter time.
Okay. The water slide, I don't recall whether or not the Massey case, which was, of course, a Minnesota case, not a Wisconsin case, I don't recall whether or not it described the actual physical size. It is clear that the slide in question was designed to be removable, was in fact removed on an annual basis. There is some indication that it may have been, like other pieces of playground equipment, moved from particular site to particular site, you know, merely temporarily anchored at the ends. But there simply is no indication at all as to, you know, how big it was. It could have been, my suspicion is it was nothing like the slides that one sees at Noah's Ark. I mean, it was just more like the slide that one might see at a pool that happened to be lying on the ground. But again, it's not particularly instructive. I do note that we have cited at least a couple of cases from yet other jurisdictions which have held that bleachers do constitute an improvement for purposes of similar statutes of repose.
Counsel?
Yes.
One way to decide this case is a per se rule. Bleachers, that is, all bleachers are improvements to property. You nuanced your issue. Are these bleachers improvements to property? What rule of law are you advocating for this court? I assume it is not a rule of law that if you have bleachers that are 100 feet long and 15 rows high that are bolted to asphalt, it's an improvement to real estate. So what rule of law are you advocating?
Well, that I would certainly like to be the holding of this court. But the ruling that I'm advocating is simply adherence to and proper application of the already well-established test for determining what an improvement is for purposes of this statute. The test was set forth in Callis. The test for an improvement, in turn, was simply an adoption of the ordinary test for what is an improvement. It's got to be a permanent addition or to or betterment of real property. It's got to involve the it's got to enhance the capital value. It's got to involve the expenditure of labor or money, and it's designed to make the property more useful or valuable as opposed to mere maintenance. The problem here is that the Court of Appeals did not really apply that test. It applied a similar but not identical test applicable to fixtures. It focused on the degree of physical annexation, and frankly, in a number of respects that I will describe, erred in that application and erred in departing from the appropriate standard. So the request here is not monumental. At least it is simply to return to the appropriate analysis and just as importantly, apply the appropriate analysis correctly to this particular bleacher, because I do not believe that one can reasonably conclude that this massive structure could not qualify under the established test.
Let me, if I might, interrupt for a minute. The definition that was adopted in Callis seems to have two parts to it. It talks about a permanent addition to or betterment of real property.
Yes.
Now, are you writing on the permanent addition to, or are you putting your argument on the betterment of real property, or both?
These bleachers clearly qualify under both. They're an addition to, they're a betterment of, and they are as permanent as most structures constructed, you know, by human beings can be. I do not believe I have to choose between those two. I think they qualify under both.
I'm going to ask one more question before you get at least one, probably. It seems to me that at least with your focus on the 100 feet, 15 rows, bolted to asphalt, that at least in part, as you indicated in response to Justice Crooks, that your focus is on permanency. And again, I'm looking for, if you have, a rule of law so that if it's possible, so that it's not a matter of then deciding if something that is 50 feet long with 7 bleachers high and bolted to something other than asphalt. So it's not fact-specific with regard to permanency. Is there a bright line that you can advocate?
Your Honor, we do not advocate a bright line test. I don't believe that a bright line test is appropriate because there are an almost infinite variety of potential improvements to real estate, and frankly, I think that the established test is as good as you probably can get.
And so you're not saying that all bleachers are permanent?
No, I can well imagine, you know, you've seen bleachers that are 2 rows high and 10 feet long that 2 people can pick up and move around, could literally be thrown in the back of a pickup truck. I don't think those would qualify. But this is not that case. This is a massive structure that was always intended to sit in this place and, in fact, has sat in this place for now going on 36 years.
Thank you.
So what I'm saying is the Court of Appeals did err in its application, in its essentially reliance on the fixtures analysis. And it also erred by placing perhaps undue emphasis on the physical annexation rather than the intent of permanency, which even the fixture cases show to be the case. But at the end of the day, I do not believe it's all that critical to the disposition, because under any analysis, I think, for reasons that I've largely gone through before, already in response to your questions, that this qualifies under either of those tests. I mean, this was a structure that was selected specifically for the particular use of the property. It was an integral part of that use. It is, as we said, massive and bolted to the asphalt. There's no intent to move. And the bleachers themselves have been subject to yet further accretions and enhancements over the course of the year. So this particular structure is functionally and physically integrated into the overall configuration, purpose, and use of the real property, and, in fact, vice versa, that the real property has been changed in some respects to accommodate the improvement. And for that reason, I do not believe that the Court of Appeals decision in this regard can be sustained. Now, that is as far as the decision of the Court of Appeals went, but the plaintiffs have raised challenges to the constitutionality of the statute, and there are two challenges. The first challenge is based upon Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution, sometimes known as the certain remedy or the open courts provision. I believe that the discussion of this provision needs to be short. The dispositive case here is Aker versus the Patient's Compensation Fund, which unequivocally establishes that statutes of repose do not violate the certain remedy clause. There is no right to a remedy that is violated because the legislature itself has done away with the right. The legislature has defined substantive law, and in that case, Article 1, Section 9 is simply not implicated. Now, counsel for plaintiffs mount a second challenge to this statute, which is based upon two cases of this court which held predecessor statutes to be unconstitutional in violation of the Equal Protection Clause. Now, I will get around to describing why those cases and the statutes are distinguishable, but I think I'd like to note first there are a couple of principles that are still valid and that can be extracted from those cases. It's quite clear, one, these cases acknowledge that there may well be a good rationale for treating the construction industry differently. And second, that a statute of repose that applied with no exceptions would not be subject to an equal protection challenge. Now, this presents us with something of an ironic situation. We have here a situation where plaintiff is challenging the constitutionality of a statute because the legislature has chosen not to foreclose as many avenues of possible recourse as it might have. Well, passing that small irony, the court must consider, in evaluating the equal protection the constitutionality of the statute under the Equal Protection Clause, it must consider every possible justification for these classifications, whether expressed by the legislature or not. And must.
So why do you think it's appropriate to protect someone in the construction industry from liability under this statute?
It's, as I believe the court has actually recognized in past cases, the additions to real property have a degree of permanence that extends potential liability for those who create the improvements virtually perpetually. And the legislature has deemed it appropriate to provide an absolute cutoff for potential liability for such improvements. And the propriety of doing that has been recognized by the court.
Why? What makes people in the construction industry different than someone else that's not protected under the statute?
Well, is it relative to improvements to real estate, or are you asking, are improvements to real estate essentially different?
No, I'm asking why the individual that's protected under the statute should be protected rather than, as opposing counsel suggests, the statute's under-inclusive.
Okay, well, that question is directed toward the classifications of people who are or are not protected.
Exactly. That's the equal protection argument that you began to speak to, and that's what my question's about.
Okay. As opposed to why don't we provide similar statutes of repose for, equine activities or something like that. No.
No, I'm not talking about equine activities. I'm talking about real estate and improvements to real estate. I want to know why this class of people, of which your client is one, should have protection.
Okay. If I may, I want to proceed directly there, but it will take some setting up. And in order to understand the classifications, you must understand the reasons for the classifications. You must understand what those classifications are and how the statute is put together. The statute begins with the application to any person, anyone, specifically including the owners or occupiers of the property, who are involved in the improvement. And those persons, again, with extreme generality, after 10 years, are protected from any claim arising out of any deficiency or defect in the design, land surveying, planning or supervision, or observation of the construction of, or the furnishing of materials for that improvement. It is difficult to imagine anyone who is not covered by this general definition. The statute then goes on to carve out two and only two exceptions. One is for manufacturers or producers of defective materials and improvements. And the second is for owners or occupiers of the land, but then not for the design improvement, et cetera, but for negligence in the subsequent maintenance, operation, or inspection of that improvement. Now, that is significantly different, by the way, from the predecessor statutes. This statute, it is clear that it intends to be all-inclusive except for the specific exceptions. It does...
You seem to conclude from that, I'm looking at page 29 of your brief, that owners are therefore excluded from immunity if they are actively and continuously involved in the improvement that caused the injury. Now, I guess where I'm having some problems with that, and I'd like you to help clarify for me, is you seem to suggest that if the owner sees a problem and goes in and takes action and fixes it, the owner's immunity is excluded. But if the owner sees the problem and does absolutely nothing and allows it to continue, the owner is protected. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure that would make sense, but I don't believe that that is what our argument is. And if something in our brief seems to imply it, then I will recant. It depends upon whether the court in this subsequent case determines that the owner had a right to simply sit back, look at this dangerous condition it had discovered, and do nothing. It seems to me that a court would be likely, more likely to say, and there's nothing in the statute that prevents the court from saying, no, you discover a defect, particularly when you are opening this improvement up to the public at large, you must correct that defect. And in fact, the Safe Place statute does say that. So I don't believe that that's a problem that we face here. Is that an answer to your question, Your Honor?
That's an answer.
Okay. It is clear it's intended to be all-inclusive, subject to the specific exceptions. Owners and occupiers are specifically included within the protected class for purposes of design, construction, etc. And the exception for manufacturers is limited to liabilities for defects in material. Now, the overall logic of the statute is clear. At some point after substantial completion, the contribution of the actors who are involved vis-a-vis the initial construction should be conclusively superseded by time, the elements, and most importantly, by the duty of the users of the property to maintain, operate, and inspect the improvement with due care on a continuing basis. Now, with that extremely long prologue, let me get around to specifically addressing the question that Your Honor raised. But I must, even as to this, answer it in two parts, because the justification for each of the exceptions is different. If I could first turn to owners and occupiers of the real estate. Again, they are not excluded from the protected class for their role in the design. They are the only respect in which they are excluded relates directly to the control they continue to exercise over the improvement in the maintenance, operation, and inspection. This is germane to the purpose of the statute, this classification, and that is fundamentally the standard that we're looking for. It doesn't have to be best, it just has to be germane. Because it first recognizes that the construction of the improvements is different and presents a potential for perpetual liability that needs to be stopped at some point. Whereas it is equally rational and desirable as a matter of public policy that those in control of an improvement are in the best position to detect and cure and protect against any problem they discover on a continuing basis. Owners are also in the better position, rather than people whose job has ended and their involvement has ended 10 years ago, they're in a better position to monitor the use and to assess the necessity for and the appropriate type of insurance to spread the risk, if need be. So that is, those are the justifications for distinguishing owners. And again, they're distinguished only as to post-construction activities. Now, the distinction for manufacturers and producers of defective material is different. And there are several, within the rationale, there are several different justifications, each of which is related, but each of which is distinguishable to some extent. The first is, the standards by which materials are judged to be defective, and that is the standard by which the manufacturers are going to be held liable, if at all, are less likely to change over time than the standards by which designers, contractors, et cetera, are judged to be negligent. And because of this, manufacturers face less risk of having their past acts judged by current standards. This general problem was recognized in Tomczak versus Bailey in upholding the statute of repose applicable to surveyors. Second, and again, closely related but distinguishable, the proof of due care in the design, construction, supervision, etc., of an improvement is highly dependent on contemporaneous witness accounts, that is 10, or in this case 36 and going, years ago. Whereas the determination of a product defect, a material defect, not a product defect, a defect in material, hinges largely on post-facto forensic analysis. Thus, the passage of time is less likely to result in injustice or an inability to defend on the part of the manufacturers than it would be on the part of the designers, contractors, etc. Third, again different but closely related, the acts of one who designs, constructs, supervises, etc., an improvement to real property are taken in relation to a specific improvement. The manufacturer of material, on the other hand, acts without reference to the specific application and only with reference to stuff that it is manufacturing. It is, therefore, the scope of its potential liability is narrower. The degree to which it can stray to the left or the right off the path is narrower than one who is generally involved in the construction or in supervision of the improvement. And finally, true material defects, while not always the case, are more likely to avoid detection longer than construction defects, and hence less likely to be cured by the owners, et cetera, who have a continuing duty to maintain, operate, and inspect the premises. For all these reasons, I believe that the distinction drawn between the two classifications who are excluded from the protective class is rational and germane to the purpose of the statute.
Mr. Apfeld, I've got a question, and maybe I'm misreading the statute as it now exists, but I understand it to say in subsection 4, this section does not apply to any of the following, and it talks in B, as you've just been discussing, a person who expressly warrants or guarantees the improvement to real property for the period of the warranty or guarantee. Now, in this particular situation, I understand ITW is not the organization that put up the improvement. You're a successor corporation. What's the significance to you of the language for the period of that warranty or guarantee? I assume that's long gone.
I am not aware that any warranty or guarantee was given. I should tell you that when I have spoken of two exceptions, I have ignored these others because no one has thought fit to discuss them because they're obviously inapplicable, and frankly, I'm not sure that anyone can question the rationale of distinguishing people who set out to defraud others. But the rationale behind this particular provision is that parties should be free, particularly constructors, designers, et cetera, should be free to extend the period under which they will be liable. It's certainly rational. People can contract for that. Presumably, additional compensation would be exchanged for a longer period of time. There's nothing about the language that would indicate that it shortens the period of time, certainly not with regard to a personal injury action by a third party who is not in privity with the contract. But with regard to this particular case, I am not aware of any warranty, and it is inconceivable. There's no evidence that any warranty was given, and it's somewhat inconceivable that the warranty would have extended 31 years. If there are no further questions, I will save further marks for reply. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Atfield. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney David Lasker, representing Lane Marie Cohn and Ronnie A. Cohn. Counsel?
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I am here today to represent Elaine Cohn and her parents. The Court of Appeals got it right. These bleachers are not a permanent addition or a permanent betterment to the property. And I wish to draw the Court's attention in particular to the evidence that's in the record of this case. There's no evidence in the case, in the record of this case, about this thing being bolted to the asphalt. That's been added as rhetorical argument by...
Counsel, is it dispositive of our decision that they are or they are not bolted?
No, I think it's a relevant factor, but it certainly is not dispositive. The reason that these bleachers are not permanent, first of all, is that the bid for them explicitly in block capital letters refers to them as portable bleachers. That's what the school district was buying, and that's what ITW installed. The photos we submit do demonstrate that they are portable, even if there were a bolt into the ground. They obviously just rest there, and they obviously can be taken apart. In fact, it's undisputed in this record that they can be disassembled and moved elsewhere. The only argument that's made is that so far that hasn't happened. I think it's very important also, and it's undisputed in this record, that the bleachers were not specifically designed for the space that they occupy. They can be used on any football field or any place where they can be set in place. Now, the two cases that this Court has decided, the Callis case and the U.S. Fire Insurance Company case, demonstrate clearly a distinction which is not met factually in this case. These bleachers are different from a custom-fitted sprinkler system that's been permanently installed. Obviously, the sprinkler system is designed for that particular purpose. It is built into the building that is a part of the real estate. Likewise, and that, of course, was in the Callis case, the sprinkler system. In the U.S. fire case, we had an underground pipeline, which was held to be a permanent betterment to real estate. Clearly, that is distinguishable from these bleachers.
Mr. Lasker, even if you're correct in regard to a permanent addition, let's assume that these are indeed portable, it's not a permanent addition. How do you handle the betterment of real property? Isn't that clearly what was occurring here, a betterment of the real estate?
Yes, but again, the phrase is a permanent betterment. I believe that
you're
that's
reading
the
it that
statute.
Way. We don't necessarily have to read it that way, do we?
Well, I would respectfully submit that when it says a permanent addition to or betterment of, it is the word permanent is describing both.
What is permanent? Tell me, what are you talking about? Is it something that's been there 20 years, 50 years?
I don't think that the question is one of time. There's no dispute that these bleachers have been there over 30 years.
Permanent it implies time, doesn't it?
Well, that may be a factor, but I think that a much more critical factor to permanence, as demonstrated by the decision in Callis and the decision in U.S. Fire, is whether it is a part of the real estate in a true sense, not just something that can sit there on the real estate for three decades. They could have been moved at any time, and that's why they're not permanent.
What's the law on mobile homes?
I don't know. I don't know. Again, I think it would probably depend a great deal on whether they're on rolling tires that are brought in and out, or whether they're actually affixed to the real estate like a house. But that's just frankly off the top of my head, Your Honor. I'd like to address the issue of the problem with this statute in terms of the Equal Protection Clause, and that is, I think, the dispositive constitutional issue. It is not rational and reasonable that the statute should apply to ITW, but not to the manufacturer or producer of the material. ITW chose and knowingly distributed and erected these defective bleachers. It claims immunity from suit only because more than 10 years have passed since it did so. But the statute would not protect the manufacturer of the very same product that ITW chose to distribute and erect. That is not rational. Both ITW and the manufacturer are similarly situated. Nothing has changed regarding the work product of either party since the bleachers were put up. And opposing counsel made mention of the fact that post facto forensic analysis is needed when you talk about a defectively manufactured product. But our case against ITW is likewise based upon forensic analysis by expert witnesses as to whether this item that has been distributed and put in place is inherently defective. The work of ITW is covered by the statute. The work of the manufacturer is exempt from coverage, and that's not rational or reasonable. There is no reasonable or rational explanation for that. ITW makes explanations. It says that it's rational because the statute covers only the improvement. I'm referring to their brief now, the work that goes into the planning, designing, and completing of the project, not just a defect in the material used. And it also says that it deserves protection because it only put the product, the defective product, which it should have recognized as such, together and set it in place. And it says that it's rational that the statute should exempt them from the coverage. That it's rational that the statute should exempt from coverage the manufacturer of the defective product, which also should have recognized that its product was defective. Now, again, that doesn't make sense. The wrongdoing, the alleged wrongdoing of the party procuring and erecting the defective product and the party making it are the same. They both negligently placed a defective product likely to cause harm. But when you think about it, ITW's negligence is even more egregious than the manufacturer because it knowingly put this specific danger in place where it sits today. Neither the manufacturer nor the school district received the protection of this statute. What Chief Justice Heffernan said in the Funk case was the protections and favors of this statute.
So this case may be a bit more obvious because of the nature of the bleachers, but whatever rule we come up with is going to apply further than this case. So I think I need to ask this question. I guess I can envision a situation where a manufacturer of a product, it would make sense to assume that they would know more about the product than someone who procures the product and passes it off to a third party. Now, I'm assuming your argument in this case is the defect should be obvious because you've got the gaps there and anybody could see it. But that's not necessarily going to be true in all cases of this nature. So doesn't the opposing counsel have a point in saying, wait a minute, there really is a distinction here with the manufacturer. They really should know more about the product and have a better idea of the nature of the product and the problems of the product?
Well, there really is a distinction, but the question is whether the distinction is one that makes a rational and reasonable underpinning for just blanket dismissal from liability. I would submit, Your Honor, that that the rules of tort law take care of the interests of all of the parties. Every party has its defenses, and those defenses would justly apply to the facts of the particular case.
So we're talking about the equal protection argument from the face of the statute?
Yes. Well, from the face of the statute, I think that that it is not true that a manufacturer has an easier problem defending itself than a contractor or a distributor. The proof is there in the existing structure and can be looked at, whether 10 years have passed or whether 20 or 30 years have passed. If the problem is the maintenance of the structure, again, the party has its defenses. It can blame that it wasn't maintained properly. But if the problem is in the inherent defectiveness of the product, there's no distinction between the manufacturer and the distributor. And so I submit to you that this is an irrational and unreasonable situation, especially from a public policy point of view. It is indeed protecting one potential defendant where it doesn't protect another without good reason or rationality.
Speaking of the public, isn't that what the legislature who defines the public policy of this state set that limitation? I mean, one would assume the public policy was expressed in the legislation.
Well, public policy is a question for the legislature, but I think that
You'd like the court to express its public policy?
Well, no. The court, though, I think does have to look at the question of whether there is a reasonable and rational basis for this statute in the context of what is reasonable and rational public policy. And to that extent, it's part of the context that the court has to consider. ITW says that the quality of the work of those not covered by the statute, the quality of the work of the maintenance or the manufacturer, can be fairly judged on the quality of the work as it was when the maintainer or the manufacturer completed their work. But again, so can ITW's work be evaluated today just as it was completed. There is no question that the record demonstrates that there has not been any change whatsoever with regard to this bleachers in the entire time it's been there, and therefore the record demonstrates that its work can be fairly judged today, just as it completed that work. In our brief, we argue that a defective roller coaster can be viewed as an improvement to real estate much more reasonably than portable bleachers resting on the ground. And it would make no sense to say that the company that chose the roller coaster and put it there is less responsible than the company that manufactured the roller coaster in the first place. But that is what ITW is arguing. If negligent maintenance or manufacture is the problem, then ITW has that defense. If maintenance alone is the problem, both the manufacturer and the distributor would have that defense. Public policy does not dictate that the distributor should have an arbitrary and complete defense under a statute of repose that a manufacturer does not have. Public policy does not demonstrate a need for either party to have more than the ordinary defenses in a tort case. In the Callis case, it was pointed out that material men were ignored under the old statute 893.155, and they are virtually ignored under this statute as well. That irrationality, which was one of the reasons that it was struck down by this court, exists and persists in the current law today. ITW says that active ongoing negligence is excluded from liability under 893.89 because it exempts owners and occupiers from protection. But exempting only them, owners and occupiers, and not manufacturers too, does not go far enough, and it's irrational. Moreover, it's not true that all of the ongoing negligence is excluded under ITW's interpretation of the statute. Only its own negligence is excluded, even though its negligence was ongoing at the time of Elaine's injuries in this case. In the Funk case, the court questioned what it referred to as the control rationale, which is the rationale I submit that ITW is espousing. It pointed out that people like component parts manufacturers often, quote, have less control over a completed building than do architects and engineers who may, at least, conduct inspections prior to turning buildings over to owners, close quote. Nonetheless, under that statute, as with this statute, they are not afforded protection while ITW is. The school, which is clearly not afforded protection by this statute with regard to maintenance, could have polished and shined those bleachers every day for the last 30-some years without ever knowing the danger posed by the defective product itself. Yet the school is open to liability, and the distributor who knowingly put that defective product there is not. Again, Chief Justice Heffernan, writing for the court in Funk, said, the statute still affords its protection and favors without a reasonable and rational basis. It violates the Wisconsin and United States constitutional guarantees of equal protection in the same way, albeit perhaps to a lesser degree, than did the old Section 893.155. The statute, as revised, he wrote, is unconstitutional, just as the original statute was. And for that same reason, the statute in its current form is still unconstitutional.
Counselor, if I understand what you're basically arguing to us, it appears that you're resting your constitutional claim solely on equal protection, have kind of given up the ghost on Article 1, Section 9. Is that correct?
Not quite.
That's the ghost that remains after 8.
The ghost that remains, and I do acknowledge that after the Aker case, it is clear that a statute of repose is enforceable, in other words, does not violate Article 1, Section 9, only because it rests upon sound public policy. In the Aker case, we were talking about medical malpractice, where there was a very sound public policy underpinning for the rule in question. And in the CCL Associates case, in the contract law context, it was seen to be clearly good public policy. But this is a tort case, which is very different than contract or medical malpractice itself. And as we point out in my brief at page 34, note 5, there are important reasons why a tort case why public policy is not served by this kind of a blanket rule. Now, I've already told you why public policy does not reasonably support the equal protection rationale, and I'm saying that the Cones, because of the unconstitutionality of the statute in terms of the equal protection clause, the Cones do have a right to a sure remedy. And for that reason, if the statute were held to apply to it and bar them from a suit today against ITW, that would be a violation of Article 1, Section 9.
That's kind of a bootstrap, isn't it? We'd have to find it unconstitutional before we could find that it violated Article 1, Section 9, so it'd have to be doubly unconstitutional to fit. I don't know that we generally do that.
Well, it would have to, it would violate Article 1, Section 9 for two reasons. One is the bootstrap reason that the statute is, violates equal protection. The other is that there is not a sound public policy basis for it. And if that's true, then Article 1, Section 9 can be violated by the statute, or by the application of the statute.
So you would say the whole statute needs to topple over because the remedy against this particular class of people has been taken away?
Yes. Yes,
just
precisely.
Just understand where you are.
Yes, precisely that.
Mr. Lasker, if you were going to attempt to draft a statute that you think would be constitutional, what would you do?
I'm not sure you can. I think that maybe three strikes is, means we're out on trying to do this. And I don't see that any harm is done because all of the defenses are available to those parties who would be involved in the tort action. And it's not unfair to take away the special privilege that befalls ITW and not the others involved. I think the legislature has attempted to fix the problem and demonstrated that it can't. Unless there are any further questions.
I have one more question on your public policy argument. Isn't the legislature, aren't we supposed to let the legislature determine public policy and not say the public policy they chose is no good, the court's got a better one, so we're striking the statute?
As I was saying to, in answer to Justice Crook's question, I think that public policy, or it may have been Justice Wilcox, pardon me, but in any event, public policy is a question for the legislature. But the case law in applying the rationality test with regard to equal protection says that one aspect of it is to look at rationality and reasonableness.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it in your equal protection argument.
Mm-hmm.
I have a problem with it as a basis for there's no right to a remedy here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the Article 1, Section 9. And seems to me that what the legislature did is set out public policy by enacting this statute. They talked about it a lot and they got the governor to sign it. And I guess I wonder how we can say, well, just because we don't like that public policy, it's not rational, it violates Article 1, Section 9.
I guess I think the court is free to take a look at whether there is a basis, in fact, for saying that it serves the public policy or it serves the public. And I think the court is capable of finding that it does not.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I thank you, and I relinquish to my opponent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lasker. Mr. Apfeld.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may address a number of assertions by counsel for plaintiffs. Callis, the decision in Callis dismisses the control of owners and occupiers of real estate as a rationale for that statute. It is important to understand what that court was saying. What the court was saying is that the subsequent control over the maintenance, repair, and operation of the premises, although that phrase wasn't used in the statute, but the subsequent control of the owners or occupiers is irrelevant to determining whether the owner or occupier should be within the protected class for its role in the design, construction, et cetera, of the improvement in the first place. In that regard, the court was perfectly right, and it is now perfectly immaterial to the statute before us. With regard to its discussion of the justification for material men, The court simply did not have before it the justifications that we have advanced. To the contrary, the court appeared to rely, as it had in at least two cases before it, to focus only upon the traditional justifications for statutes of limitations as, in essence, limits on dilatory plaintiffs. And I think we have gone substantially beyond that, both in our general recognition of the functions of statute of repose, as well as our discussion here today about the function of this particular statute of repose. With regard to counsel's suggestion that Article 1, Section 9 depends upon the assertion of a sound public policy, Your Honors, I must reject that out of hand. I don't believe it has any support in the law. It's not supported by the text of the statute. Certainly, there is some limited room for an analysis of the public policy within the context of the equal protection, but certainly not within an Article 1, Section 9 provision. Counsel has suggested that there is no distinction between the role of ITW, or rather its predecessor in this case, and the role of the manufacturer of materials. I have attempted to articulate the design, the differences. But to go on, you must understand the so-called defect that is involved here. This is not as though a piece of angle iron failed. It is because there is no backboard or frontboard that prevents someone from falling in. Is that required? Well, there has been a change over time in the standards applicable to that. And also, the decision as to whether or not to put that or any other protective device is dependent upon the particular application. You know, was this or was this not going to be used by children? And was it, did the use change over time? In that respect, ITW stands in a significantly different position than the supplier of an angle iron that may have failed, and that, of course, is not the case.
If I could, Mr. Apfel, I'm concerned about the how far this rule may cover, but looking at the specific facts in the case, understanding your point that the standards have changed,
yes.
I think Mr. Lasky's point was that since we're talking about the gaps in the bleachers, that should be readily apparent not just to the manufacturer but also to the distributor. They should be aware of that because you can see it.
You can see it, but whether or not it constitutes a departure from the standard of care is highly time-dependent. Our position will be that conformed with the standard of care in 1969, regardless of what you may think today. It is a difference. It does change over time. Moreover, the owner of the property is in a position, since it sees what it's conditioned every day, it's in a position to make those changes if the standards have changed or the use has changed. Moving perhaps backwards from the constitutional issues into the question of permanency, there's a suggestion that it needs to be custom made for these specific premises. Now, in fact, the size was determined, but that sort of position has been both implicitly and explicitly rejected, for example, as to silos, implicitly rejected in the Funk case, and explicitly rejected at least under a fixtures analysis in the Department of Revenue versus A.O. Smith case, which I believe is cited in our briefs. And finally, the notion that this is not permanent, that it is portable because it could be taken apart, I think that the court should reject that. First, in this case, you will always have a 10-year look back, always. And I might note, just in passing, think of the Eiffel Tower. The Eiffel Tower was intended to be temporary. It was intended to be taken down after the Paris Exposition. Would anyone today contend that that is not an improvement to real property? I think not, even though you could disassemble every nut and bolt on it. If I may just summarize, Your Honor.
In sum, please.
This is precisely the sort of structure the legislature intended to fall within the statute of repose, and the distinctions made within that statute are highly germane to the purposes behind it. If there are no further questions, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Apfeld, and thank you, Mr. Lasker, for your argument today. Third case reaching this court on liability of construction. Thank you. That closes our hearing on 03-1067 Cohn v. Darlington Community Schools. The court will take a short recess so that these students may leave if they wish to, and others may enter the courtroom.